Returning now to the Chabaouk prophecy, we still have Glenn with us. Hopefully he will chime in as we go through this. Yahweh has already laid out the fact that there's a singular male individual that is going to be specifically renouncing Yahweh's commitment to continue to stand up for his personal responsibilities and stand for his requirements for engaging in a relationship with him. So he began by stating that and then told us that the timing that this person is going to come onto the scene is at the time that the moed are fulfilled. He's then gone on to say that he is going to be extraordinarily unsupportive, condemning, going to rebuke this individual, going to reject what he has to say because he's contradicting God. And in fact, the prophecy states specifically that this person is going to claim to speak about and for God. And yet, what he says is antagonizing God to the point where God is saying, I'm extraordinarily hostile to what this individual is saying. So that's the context thus far. And he says, pay attention. He will be puffed up with false pride. Now, it's the Hebrew word, afal, is very interesting here. That it doesn't say that he's just haughty and arrogant, but that he's presumptuous, heedless of the truth. It's an interesting word for arrogant. And certainly Paul was amongst the most arrogant, infamous people who ever lived. Now, you'd have to put Paul on your top five most arrogant, famous figure list. He constantly talked about his ego. In fact, in 2 Corinthians, he even says that Satan had to possess him, had to control him, had to have a thorn, a goad in his side to keep his ego in check. But it's not just ego. It's presumptuousness. It's false pride. It's having, being heedless of the truth. And in this case, Paul's great claim to fame was that he was authorized by God to be the sole spokesperson to Gentiles. And that he was taught by God himself and that God chose him from the womb. Well, it's all false. So it's not just an arrogant claim. It's a false claim. Now, I suppose that you could be conceited and have justification. You know, if I could play basketball like LeBron James, I'd be pretty full of myself as it relates to my basketball prowess. You know, if I could sing, you know, like Frank Sinatra, you know, I'd probably be pretty full of myself as a singer. You know, I can't. And if Paul was brilliant, if Paul was extraordinarily articulate, if Paul could convey ideas powerful, clearly, rationally, providing evidence to support his conclusions, then, you know, he'd have some reason at least to have pride in his chosen profession. But he was awful at those things. And on top of that, this barely literate individual, this inarticulate, irrational individual who by his own admission was insane, claimed that he was the lone person chosen by God to convey an entirely new message that was entirely different than the message that he had previously communicated. He even goes so far as to claim that God was inadequate as it relates to the task of salvation and that Paul had to sacrifice his body physically as well to make up for what was lacking. Well, when a guy claims to speak for God in his single most repetitive phraseology is what I, Paul, say. We've got a problem. So pay attention. He will be puffed up with false pride. Even the word pay attention is insightful here. It's henna. Henna is the letter hey that appears twice in Yahweh's name. It depicts a person standing up, reaching up, looking up, paying attention. And it's by paying attention that you make this transition. Glenn mentioned that he spent a semester in biblical studies. But somewhere along the way, he started to pay attention. Oh, Glenn, go ahead.
Well, I got a degree in biblical studies from a college. Studied it at an Arizona State University and found the curriculum unbearable. So, of course, I went to a Christian school. But then I went to a covenantal seminary, basically in a school that was like Princeton. I didn't go to Princeton, but it was the Princeton theology.
Right. Does this word resonate with what you've attempted to do over these past few years? Pay attention, henna?
Well, yeah, absolutely. Well, the thing is, I've been mindful of the cacophonous nature of all these many contradictions. Studies religion and philosophy. Mm-hmm. And that sort of thing. So I'm aware of all this, all these great many contradictions,
Right.
So, it's like, okay, well, I'm not going to involve myself in trying to instruct others, on this stuff.
Right. The nice thing about coming to be aware of paying attention to the contradictions is at least it causes you to be open to a reasonable explanation. If somebody can say, yeah, here's all these contradictions, but here is a reasonable explanation of a plausible answer that is devoid of contradictions, that resolves all these contradictions, and if you're paying attention, that's going to appeal to you. But if you're not questioning the contradictions in your religion, then chances are you're never going to pay attention.
Well, if you understand logic, you realize it's not a matter of Hegelian synthesis. You don't take contradiction number one, rabbinic Judaism, and synthesize it with contradiction number two, Pauline Christianity, and somehow come out with a pretty result. No, you have to basically come to the conclusion, wait a minute, these are both wrong, and there's got to be another way out that's logically coherent.
Correct.
The
fact that rabbinic Judaism is wrong does not make Christianity right.
Exactly. And you can't add the two wrongs together and get a right.
That is also correct. It's why I'm so cautious when somebody has a different approach to coming to know Yahweh that will help somebody who is lost in a delusion like Christianity come to know him. And your proposal today was not a compromise. It's not the idea of, let's use a wrong to lead people to the right. It was really quite astute and is a reasonable approach to this. But it's you've got to pay attention.
Ask you to give up your perception of Yahusha as the Passover Lamb, as the Messiah. And we're gonna correct that, flesh it out, and help you really lay hold of that. But in order to do so, you have to relinquish the other thing that you're clinging to, which is preventing you from doing that.
Yeah, we're not going to even have you relinquish the idea that he's the Son of God.
Exactly.
You don't have to give up any of that, but you'll eventually have to give up your Trinity. But you'll actually get to embrace a far better explanation of who Yahweh is and how he manifests himself that will be devoid of the pagan trappings. That'll make a great deal of sense. It'll be consistent with what he says. What you'll end up with is a superior understanding, and it also happens to have the benefit of being true.
Well, when I think of Paul before his conversion, I think of Yahusha rebuking the scribes and Pharisees, saying, "You count the seven and earth, trying to make one proselyte. When you find him, you make him tenfold the child of hell as yourself." That would have been Paul prior to his conversion. And then, Paul did he conducted a little market research and looked at the demographics, and he realized he had a much wider market available in the Gentiles. Yes, you know, exactly. Why should I market selling to these Jews over here? Isn't working too good. You know, yeah.
Plus the fact these Jews, they know too much. The myth that I'm promoting isn't going to prevail amongst Jews because they'll know that I'm lying. But the Gentiles don't know enough about what I'm saying, and therefore they're going to be easy to deceive. It's kind of like Muhammad. Muhammad's religion is really stupid. If he had tried to sell that religion to an enlightened community, had he been 500 miles further east in Persia, had he been 500 miles further west in Egypt, had he been 500 miles further north in today's Turkey, which was either Greek or Persian, depending on the time, or Roman, had he been anywhere other than where he was, he would have found that his audience would have been well enough educated that they would have completely rejected everything he said. The same thing was true with Paul.
Yeah, ridden him out of town on the rail, yeah.
Right, but the same was true with Paul.
I think the post-Civil War carpetbagger, he was like a carpetbagger.
Right. You know? The reason that Paul ended up being so hostile to Jews, and, you know, if you read his first five letters are written to condemn Jews. The Jews are the enemy. In fact, Christians know it. I mean, that's why Christians came up with this concept of a Judaizer, because they realized that Paul's first five letters are all lashing out at Jews as the enemy, and it's because the Jews knew that he was a liar. They were informed. They knew that what he was saying was untrue, that you could not claim to speak for the God of the Torah and contradict him. It just was a non-starter. So the key thing here, and this is where Christians have failed as a whole with regard to this prophecy, pay attention. Hannah, pay attention. Then it goes on to say he will be puffed up with false pride. His soul is not right or straightforward, lo yashar, in him. And there are lots of ways for when Yahweh speaks of the soul, that's the individual consciousness, the individual persona, the individual's unique character and attitude. We talked about this a moment ago. And it's saying that this particular soul, it's not right. Not straightforward. What you're getting isn't the whole truth. That this soul is specifically attempting to present himself as something that he is not. We'll be back. So as God is continuing to describe this individual, who he will name as Shaul, which Paul confirms that is his name, because he even says that when the spirit, the lightning, accosts him on the road to Damascus, it referred to him as Shaul, Shaul. So he himself confirms that's his Hebrew name. And in this particular case, it says that he's going to be puffed up with false pride, which is the single most universal characteristic of Paul in terms of his own admission. And that his soul is not right or straightforward in him, which means that he is pretending to be something that he's not. It either means that he's using circular reasoning or that he is perverted in some way. Go ahead, Glenn.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, let me jump right in because this is an example. I've always especially loved the way he tries to, like, he realizes he's trying to appeal to his market, right? And he doesn't want any other competing salesman to horn in on his market because he said he's not going to do that to others. I don't want to infringe on any other man's work. But he makes good and sure he tries to sully the reputation of Shimon Kefesh. Because he says that when he came down from Jerusalem, I withstood him to his face, for he was to be blamed, because he was hanging with the Gentiles. He was hanging out with both the Jews and the Gentiles. But when certain other important persons came down from Jerusalem, he wouldn't hang with the Gentiles anymore. He was hanging with the Jews, and I withstood him to his face, for he was to be blamed. In America, this would be like you're socializing in a mixed-race environment, you know, white people, black people, Hispanics, and you're a white person or something, and you're talking to everybody and get along, and then when your racist friends come arrive, then you go and socialize only with them. So that was
You're exactly correct. Now, let's just take Yahweh's position on this, because he has a lot to say about it. When somebody comes into Jerusalem or to Israel and wants to participate in the invitations, wants to participate in the covenant, wants to be accepted into the family, does Yahweh say, no, if they're not Jewish, they're not welcome?
Absolutely not.
Does Yahweh says that he doesn't want his chosen people, the Israelites, emulating the ways, the behavior, the philosophies, the religion, the politics of the Gentiles. But he never says you must reject Gentiles because of their race, does he?
Absolutely not. No, this is just, treat wayfarers or, well.
When Yahusha was walked among us during his sixth visit, and he is, talking with people in large crowds, when a Roman would come up to him and ask him a question, did he reject engaging the Roman in conversation?
No. Would you please heal my daughter? For I am a man under authority, and I say to one, go, and he goes, and another, come, and he comes. A Roman approaches him with a complete understanding of his authority, defers to it, and asks for mercy on his daughter, and Jesus grants him his wish.
So this idea that it is somehow inappropriate for a Yehudim, a Israelite, to eat with, to socialize with non-Israelites is not something that Yahweh ever condemns in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. It is, however, part of Rabbinic Judaism. So Paul, as a Rabbinic Jew, if he's representing Rabbinic Judaism, Jews were held themselves to be superior, and they didn't want to associate with the rebel. It's one of the big condemnations that the rabbis had of Yahusha, is that he didn't play by their rules, which was to disassociate from even being in the presence of Gentiles, which they thought were inferior, and Yahusha treated all people the same. Their skin color was immaterial to him, and in this case, Paul is making a distinction on behalf of Rabbinic Judaism to condemn Shimon Kefesh, not the Torah prophets and Psalms.
Yeah, and he's accusing Shimon Kefesh of doing that. Now, whether or not he actually did, I'm not sure, but it certainly is convenient that Paul gets to call into question the authority of Shimon Kefesh and the moral consistency of Shimon Kefesh, and to draw attention to himself.
Correct, and what's so telling is the argument he brought against Shimon Kefesh was a rabbinic religious argument. So Paul took the rabbi's point of view when, if it's a true story, Shimon was taking Yahweh's approach. One of the conundrums that Christians don't seem to want to embrace, but another reason to reject Paul, if you want to embrace Yahusha as the Messiah, is that here Paul is condemning what Christians know as Peter. His actual name is Shimon Kefesh. Shimon. He's condemning Shimon for socializing with Gentiles, breaking bread with them, talking with them, communicating with them, investing time in their lives. That was his condemnation. And then when somebody from Jerusalem arrived, he went and talked with them. In other words, he prioritized his relationship with Yehudim, with Israelites, while investing time and specifically going out of his way to meet with and nurture Gentiles. All right, so let's compare that to Yahusha. Yahusha said, to Israelites first, Yehudim first, and then to the rest of the world. Shimon is following that exact instruction, exactly. investing the time in the rest of the world, but still prioritizing the chosen people. So you can either accept that Yosha's testimony and instruction in this regard is valid, and therefore what Shimon was doing was exactly what he should be doing, and therefore that Paul's condemnation of him is an affront to Yosha. It's an actual attack on Yosha. Or you can be irrational, I guess, and stay a Christian. Now, next. Yosha specifically spoke of how he needed to go away post-Bukurim so that that his family, the covenant, the disciples, would be able to receive the set-apart spirit. And that this occurred on Shavuah. And when they received the set-apart spirit on Shavuah, they were enriched with a much better understanding of Yahweh's Torah, his teaching, but they were empowered. And the way they were empowered was very specifically delineated. They were empowered to speak the languages of the Gentiles. They already spoke Hebrew. They were empowered to speak Greek and Aramaic and Latin and Arabic. And, you know, the Egyptian dialects. They were empowered to speak the languages of the Gentiles. That was the specific purpose of the empowerment on Shavuot. And it's just this whole list of Gentile nations and their languages and their cultures that were listed. And they were empowered to speak those languages so they could communicate what they had been enriched to learn to them. Now, if they weren't supposed to go out and engage and break bread with and talk with and invest time in and teach those Gentiles, what was the purpose of Shavuot? Why did Yosha speak of it in those terms? It's senseless.
If that was the case, why would he even ever mention Gentiles?
Exactly.
Why would he even mention that he's... Why would Yah speak to Gentiles?
Why would the book of Yirmiyah, which specifically demeans Christmas, Easter, and all things Babylonian, and the religion of Christianity is extraordinarily Babylonian, why would it be devoted to Gentiles if God did want to speak to Gentiles? I mean, come on, folks. I mean, this isn't really hard to understand that Paul was using an argument that was based in the rabbinic, Pharisaic religion to condemn Shimon, who was doing exactly what Yosha had asked us to do, all of us. So there's only, you've got a choice here. You can reject what Paul's condemnation of Shimon, Peter, and reject Paul for writing it down, for issuing it, for deceiving in this way, for being opposed to Yahweh, or you can reject Yosha, Yahweh, God himself. Those are your options. You can't have both. And Paul would try to sell you on having both, and that's impossible. That's why he could not speak to an educated audience, why he had to speak to those who were ignorant of Yosha, ignorant of the Torah. That's why he never cites anything Yosha ever said, because if he cited what he said and what he did, then it would be obvious that he was contradicting him with his every word. So pay attention. He, speaking of Shaul, of Paul, will be puffed up with false pride, presumptuous and heedless of the truth. His soul's not right, not straightforward in him. He does not consider anything appropriately. He is circuitous in his reasoning. He wanders away by twisting and convoluting the teaching. And with him, nothing is on the level. That's why Paul admitted that he was this very guy when his soul was not right, when he said that he had been made to be sexually perverted that he was sexually perverted by the Torah. When he said that the Torah had made him violent and ruthless, he showed you that he was not right or straightforward. When he admitted to being insane, his soul's not right or straightforward. When he admitted to being demon-possessed in his second letter to the Corinthians, he was affirming that his soul was not right or straightforward. When he said that he is all things to all people, that to the Jew he pretends to be Jewish, to the Gentile he pretends to be a Gentile, to those who are Torah observant he pretends to be Torah observant, to those who are Torah adverse he is Torah adverse, and that he does all of these things to prevail, to get an unfair advantage over those that he is deceiving in this way. That's an absolute confession that he is this individual that John was speaking of. I mean, there are not a lot of people that go out to you, that go out and who openly state that I'm pretending to be what I'm not. Paul did, right in his letters. He said, I'm pretending to be what I'm not, to fool you, to take advantage of you. How many infamous people of world acclaim fit this particular statement better than him? Larry, do you know of any?
No. I mean, you know, Paul reminds me a lot of, say, you know, a stockbroker, you know, an expert here and there and knowing nothing at all.
Yes, except the consequence with the stockbroker is you might lose some of your money, and the consequence with Paul is you lose your soul.
Yeah, definitely lose your soul. There's no doubt about that. Even people that say they observe the Torah and yet try to drag his poison along with them into the home, that's not going to happen. I know a lot of people that claim to be Torah observant, and yet they stick up for Paul. You know, they're not friends of mine. I don't like them.
No.
Honestly.
No. It gets back to two wrongs trying to make a right. And there is no way, it is absolutely impossible to position Paul's antagonism towards the nomos at the Talmud. It can never be done. He never cites from the Talmud to twist the Talmud. Never once. And he knows that the term nomos is what is used throughout the Septuagint to translate Torah. I mean, you have to be completely ignorant and irrational to make the conclusion that Paul's adverse to the Talmud. And this is a great example when he condemns Shimon. He's advocating the Talmud. In fact, he admits in one of his diatribes that he was one of the most zealous followers of the traditions of the people, which would be the Talmud.
You know, this is on the subject matter, but a little off. I had somebody today tell me that they enjoyed the young earth theory. And they said that the reason that they enjoyed the young earth theory, you know, the delusion brought about.
Mm-hmm, sure. That the earth is 6,000 years old.
Yeah, through Christianity, because, you know, they don't understand Yahweh's words.
Right.
You know, and so I asked this person, I said, why do you think that in the psalm that Yahweh describes relativity if he didn't want you to understand it? Well, I had no answer.
Yeah, and why does Yahweh present the presentation of creation from two different perspectives? Why does he present it from the perspective of the Creator at creation and then retell the story from our perspective and the perspective of man here on earth if he wasn't trying to provide two relative perspectives to understand what occurred?
Right. This actually got worse because the person said, well, If the young earth theory fights the evolution, are you supporting evolution? And I said, so what you're telling me is that you're going to fight an ignorant concept with a different ignorant concept.
Yeah. By the way, you know, evolution in the sense of finches, with short beaks, evolving to finches with longer beaks. In places where longer beaks are advantageous, that's got no problem with that. I mean, it's factually proven. That's why Iona said they will multiply after their kind. I've got no problem with varieties of dogs being evolved because they're of the way that they're bred.
They've lost genetic material, but they didn't magically gain it anywhere. And that's the concept of macroevolution. So what I told the guy was, what you're saying is that Yahweh was standing on this planet when he created this planet. Yeah, I mean, that's what it would be.
That means that the universe had to precede the Christian God.
It's just bizarre.
Yeah, stay with us, Larry. We've got another segment left. I happen to love talking about creation because Yahweh's testimony is so precise, so accurate scientifically, so illuminating that it's fun to make fun of the religious. Welcome back to the last segment of Shattering Myths for today. We're having a conversation with Larry, who engaged the fellow who was celebrating the young Earth. And Larry, going back about 6 years ago, there were a series of articles on Christian beliefs. And the polls that were taken, it was by Pew Research. I know you used to work for Gallup. Pew's a reasonably credible research company. Said that it was in the range of 70% of Christians that believed that the universe was 6,000 years old.
That is bizarre. But since I've conducted research interviews, I guarantee you that they say it.
You wonder how 70% of a group, I mean, even if you were to tell me that 10% of Christians believe the Earth is 6,000 years old, what you're saying is that you're willing to suspend reason, that you're willing to reject overwhelming and absolutely conclusive, undeniable evidence to the contrary, and that you're willing to do that because your religion says so?
Yeah, Josh McDowell read that, wrote about it, and said that water created the Earth a couple, 6,000 years ago.
Yeah, Josh McDowell, evidence that demands a verdict. When I was an evangelical Christian, and if you attempted to be a thinking Christian, there's only two people you could turn to. Josh McDowell was one of them. And if you read his arguments, they are so weak. They are so pedantic. It's just amazing that they appeal to Christians. But I have, and I'm looking at the book right now, Evidence That Demands a Verdict by Josh McDowell. And he proposed arguments in favor of Christian lies and favor of Christian myths, and because he had a decent vocabulary and he was a student of philosophy, he posed his lies in a way that seemed credible enough for Christians to suspend reason. The most amazing thing of all is that when you come to the creation testimony of Yahweh, his statements have been consistent throughout time, and science has finally come just within the last 50 or so years to accepting everything he actually said from the beginning, that the universe had a beginning, that the universe was expanding, that the universe began with a big bang, that the universe had a transition from energy to matter, and it was during that transition that time began, that time itself is relative. He spoke of the clearing of the Earth's atmosphere at this precise time. He spoke of where life began, which was in the oceans, and that it began with plant life.
Take some reading or investigating, and also he spoke about the way time rolls out. If you understand it,
right?
Everything he said he made on any given day was found in the fossil record. These are all mighty big accidents. What he said wasn't true,
It's been written down and been available for study for over 3,000 years, and yet It's just in the last 50 years that science has said, all of that's true. They won't acknowledge that it's true, but all of their conclusions now and all of the evidence is consistent with exactly what he said. You don't have to, I mean, Christian, you don't have to cling to a lie. You don't have to make a fool of yourself with your young earth and your 6,000-year-old theory, because God never said any such thing.
You know, there are people the Aborigines as an example over in Australia,
mm-hmm.
that claim to have a 40,000-year history. I don't understand the concept of let's all get goofy together.
Yeah.
You know, so what, secular humanism, the concept that, the language of DNA popped out of the sky, and so did everything else,
just think of the complexity of that. When we communicate in written language, we do it as a two-dimensional construct. That's the best we can do, is a two-dimensional construct. And DNA is a three-dimensional construct. You have, two lines that revolve around each other in this elegant helix of formation. And you have the letters that are put together in such a way that you actually create the very program, the very database from which life is orchestrated. And to realize that now, to understand it and to map it, takes supercomputers, and we're not able to figure out that that's a language and had a creator.